Blog Talk Radio.
Happy New Year. It's January 1st, the first day of 2013, or 6013 Anno Lucas. Welcome back to Home Companion, and I'm your host, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to be here, and of course, we have more questions than answers coming out to you. I hope continue to offer me your sage advice on all things important and relevant in the world. It's a spectacular day here in middle Ontario. Sunrise isn't until 8 o'clock in the morning. As you know, we've passed the solstice and now the sun is climbing on the horizon. It still sets just a few minutes before 4 or 5 o'clock every day. So we have to appreciate the opportunities that we have for light in so many different ways. I want to thank you all for the incredible and growing support during 2012. It was nothing short of overwhelming. It's only going to encourage this kind of discussion. So I hope you're sitting here and you have a nice, comfortable spot. It's early morning, and we want to have a conversation, I suspect, over a cup of our favorite. And I'm starting today with a cup of good French roast coffee and a slice of fruitcake. It's the only decent thing to do under the circumstances. I want to talk today about some famous Freemasons, some stuff on Canada, maybe a little bit on resolutions, but maybe not. And talk about some. We'll get into a little more on the work of Manly P. Hall, but also some references from Tobias Churchton's work. Freemasonry, the reality. I'll talk a little bit about. We'll share a little bit of information about Anderson and de Saulnier. Again, you know, two of my the relationship that I find fascinating in Freemasonry is between these two men. One acknowledged and one often unheralded. The kind of fellow that was a remarkably bright man, we know that, may well arguably have had a more significant impact on the order as we practice it today than we might care to admit. So sit back and relax with a cup of Kool-Aid, and we'll give the world a sample of how Freemasons talk with one another to welcome a new year. whether we view time as loops or of strings of renewal or as a continuing thread, whether we understand what it is we are measuring, whether we realize time is constructed by us in the mind, how much does it really matter? We are the boys who have grown up. We are contemplative. We watch. We listen before we take action. In an era that has made politics of the notion of equality, Freemasonry stands for the debt that all people owe to themselves. Freedom. Despots can't stop it. Power. Autocracy can't stop it. Fear disguised as respect can't stop it. Only ignorance can delay the natural process of freedom, the debt owed to every little living thing. In the first chapters of Morals and Dogma, you'll find reference to this debt. Not that Albert Pike was in any sense a beacon other than he was what he was. He was a man with all the shortcomings and strengths of anybody. He was bright and well respected for what he was able to contribute, and he should be. He was real, and I would say a complex person. Within our order, each one of us is unique and complex with a texture that we can preserve for our own. And given that we are a diversified group, I hope you can help me answer a question that's been pressing on my mind for a while. The premise is something like this, that most of what we do, the choices we make, tend to ignore the facts and tend to be made on what we believe. It is like saying we ignore science and embrace the things that stroke our egos. Intellectual immaturity, I suppose. My question isn't whether or not we agree with that idea. There is too much evidence floating around. Can you help me understand if we can influence greater use of science? It is the foundation of one of the foundations of Freemasonry, to embrace the arts and science. Hopefully we'll be able to achieve that. But my question is, can we increase a greater use through our influence? And to what end? For the betterment of the world. Freemasonry is based on the fusion of science and belief. Every quark, every boson, it's all connected. The Kabbalah allows us a deeper understanding just how the mind is linked. So, beverage in hand, we plunge into another version of Masonic Home Companion. Thank you. Let's get to some stuff on Canada, this famous day. Did you know Kanata? You know where that is outside of Ottawa, like, John Ford. There's some really good Masons in that area. It's an Iroquois, St. Lawrence Iroquois word for village or settlement, just like the commercial suggests. O Canada was originally named Chant National and was written by Adolphe Bessely-Rothier with French lyrics. And the music was by Calixa Lavallée, and it was first performed in Quebec City in 1880. In 1967, the song was approved by the Parliament of Canada as the unofficial national anthem, and officially adopted on July 1st, 1980. Did you know the border between Canada and the United States is officially known as the international boundary at 5,525 miles, including 1,538 miles between Canada and Alaska? It is the world's longest border between two nations. The Canadian motto. No, it's not Audei. Amare Pisce ad Mare. Means from sea to sea. Although Nova Scotia was granted the British Empire's first flag by Charles I in 1625, Canada did not have a national flag until the 15th of February 1965, when its maple leaf flag was adopted by its parliament. Before that, the red ensign, a British maritime flag, was in general use. It probably speaks to the way that Canada was opened up to Europe through the Maritimes. And to this day, I suppose, there's many, we know that there's Newfoundlanders and Labradorians that lament the effect of Joey Smallwood bringing Newfoundland into the Confederation in 1949. Did you know that 3,855,103 square miles, Canada is the second largest country in the world, right behind Russia? We're a lonely bunch. Its population density is 8.6 people per square mile, making Canada the ninth most sparsely populated nation in the world. There's room here. Boy, we like our neighbors. The average life expectancy at birth for a Canadian is 81.16 years, eighth highest in the world. Just to give you a bit of a comparison, the United States ranks 46th. The life expectancy there is 78.14 years. Something happening here in Canada? The east coast of Canada was settled by Vikings around the year AD 1000. And archaeological evidence of a settlement has been found at Lanso Meadows in Newfoundland, of course. Did you know this? That Snorri, the first North American child to be born of European parents, Thorfinn and Gudrid, was born in Vinland around AD 1000. Congratulations, Thorfinn and Gudrid. I'm sure you made wonderful parents. Newfoundland was the first part of Canada to be explored by Europeans. And ironically, it was the last area to become a province. In 1642, a group of religious mystics from France were inspired by a vision to build a missionary city in the Canadian wilderness. Led by Paul de Charmadet de Maisonneuve and an Ursuline nun named Jeanine Mance, they founded Montreal. According to the 2001 census, 42.6% of Canadians are Roman Catholic, 23.3% are Protestant, and 16% claim to have no religion. Alert, up in the Nunavut territory, is the northernmost permanent settlement in the world. Canada became a country on July 1st, 1867, when the British North America Act was passed by the British Parliament. We're relatively young, and I know that we admire old cultures around the world, but be patient, we'll get there. 1,000 years from now, we'll be an old culture too. But we're so young, and we're so evidently new, we are using good ideas. But by comparison, they don't seem to have the same nostalgic grip on us that some of the older areas of the world would. But one day, we have something that they don't have. We have a huge, huge open landscape, and it is staggering. From the Maritimes into Quebec, the culture and the distinction of the area, the geography seems to go hand in hand with the uniqueness of the people. Did you know the Mounted Police were formed in 1873? They had 9 officers. In 1920, the Mounted Police merged with the Dominion Police to become the famous Royal Canadian Mounted Police. It now has, believe it or not, 28,000 members spread across Canada. So really, I've had the pleasure of working with some of the members. And interesting, very, very much a privilege. Large organization, not here to defend the foibles of some anybody in authority, but I've had a big gifted, I think, quite fortunate to have wonderful experiences. While ice hockey is Canada's most prevalent sport, lacrosse is the country's official sport. In the modern game of hockey was developed in Canada based on games that have been played since the 10th century. And the rules were first published in the Montreal Gazette in 1877. The Canadian James Naismith invented basketball to give his phys ed students at the YMCA in Springfield, Massachusetts, an indoor game to play during the long winters. Mm-hmm. the capital city, Ottawa, originally named Bytown after Colonel John By, who headquartered there while building the Rideau Canal to connect the Ottawa River with the Lake Ontario. Canada has the longest coastline of any country in the world, 151,600 miles. The Regent of England, currently Queen Elizabeth II, is the Canadian head of state. Curious bunch we are. New, but we also respect connectivity. Not that she comes without her own baggage. For somebody with the last name of Graham, and others out there that will understand. I suppose we can get into, we've already seen that at the Sankey lecture, big discussion about the impact of the Freemasonry being moving around the world under the British imperialist development. The North America's earliest undisputed evidence of human activity, 20,000-year-old stone tools and animal bones have been found in caves on the Bluefish River in northern Yukon. There you go. 20,000 years. And I suppose somebody is there claiming that they need to pick up after themselves, or a bylaw officer wrote them a ticket for leaving junk around him. No, that would be a health and safety, stone tools. Sorry, I slipped into a Masonic persona there. I just cannot, the one thing I can't take too seriously is myself. Everything else. North America's lowest recorded temperature was minus 81.4 degrees Fahrenheit. That's minus 63 centigrade. I was in Snag, the Yukon territory, on February 3rd, 1947. Boy, Jesus, Mary, was that a cold? That's a frosty one. You keep your double-double in a tight grip that day. Canada is also known as the home of large animals like the moose and grizzly, but it's also home to 55,000 species of insects and about, man, they've always been in my tent at one point, about 11,000 species of mites and spiders. Do you know that we have 9% of the world's renewable water supply? The official languages in Canada are English and French, and throughout Canada's history up to the current time, there have been conflicts. Conflicts? Respect. Tensions between the French and English reached a head in October 1970. We know about that. Sad part of our, but it happened. The army put an end to it. That's what this says. I think the people put an end to it. We may respect the and get upset. Well, we should for some of the shenanigans pulled in this country, but we also have a respect, a deeper respect for the rule of law, unless the people that are that we have chosen to preserve that take advantage or become overbearing. And then in Canada, it's neither army nor state. It's the people here that have little tolerance. In 1527, John Rutt of St. John's sent a letter to King Henry VIII, the first letter sent from North America. Charles Fennerty, a poet from Halifax, Nova Scotia, was the first person to use wood fibers to make paper. He started experimenting in 1839 and produced paper from wood pulp in 1841. Canadians have made many important inventions, including kerosene, the electron microscope, the electronic organ, insulin, the IMAX film system, the snowmobile, and the electric cooking range. Canada is a major producer and consumer of cheese. In 1997, Canadians produced 350,000 tons of at least 32 varieties of cheese. And now we produce a nice Merlot to go along. Anyway, and ate an average 23.4 pounds per person, with cheddar being the most popular. Well, you should never have invented nachos, or, I mean, really, or It's all those Aggies down at the University. Well, they discover a bright bunch. Who knew? We have vintners that are producing some incredible wines. Well, what goes better with a nice Canadian cheddar or nice cheese? Many famous authors have come from Canada. Lucy Montgomery from Anne of Green Gables, around the corner from the Graham Farm in Cavendish. Margaret Atwood, Handmaid's Tale, and Alice Munro. Of course, women. A black bear cub from Canada named Winnipeg, or Winnie, was one of the most popular attractions at the London Zoo after it was donated in 1915. And Winnie became a favorite of Christopher Robin Milne and inspired the stories written by his father, A.A. Milne, about Winnie the Pooh. The Moosehead Brewery in St. John, New Brunswick, turns out 1,642 bottles of beer per minute. Settle back, gentlemen. Guy Lombardo of London, Ontario, first heard Auld Lang Syne as a teenage musician when he and his brothers toured the rural areas that had been settled by Scots around his hometown. The natives of eastern Canada tell stories of a mythical giant named Glooskap, who carved out many of the region's natural features to help him overcome his twin evil brothers. It is believed that these Glooskap stories might be the origin of many of the Paul Bunyan legends. The world's strongest current is found in the Naquato Rapids in Slingsby Channel, British Columbia. The current has been measured at speeds of up to 18.4 miles per hour. You know, Alberta has 50% of the world's supply of bitumen. I didn't know that. The CN Tower in Toronto was the world's tallest freestanding structure until it was eclipsed in 2007. Here's something that's interesting. And if you haven't been there, I hope you all have a chance just to see the magnificence of Manitoulin Island. Do you know, Manitoulin Island, there's a Manitou Lake. It's the world's largest lake within a lake. It's 41.1 square miles. People up there are fabulous. They're just incredible hospitality. And it's one of those places where you visit and know that you'll want to come back again and again and again. It's remarkable. So there's a little bit of did you know things about Canada to kick off the year? I'll talk to you about a few. I know we are all on the level, but some of us have greater merit than others. We admit that. Some of us, we're a diversified bunch. We have different roles that we perform inside lodges. So anybody that would think that we're sort of we're all the same size pine tree growing. We've cut down all the forests and put up one size pine tree. And it would be a mistake. We're quite a diversified group. There's old oaks and maples and willows and hawthorn. There's all kinds of us growing, and we all have a unique role, a unique perspective, and a unique understanding of Freemasonry. If I can be at all useful to you, hopefully it will be to ask you to consider that you are Freemasonry. It's not something apart from you. You are it. It beats within your heart, within your mind. It is a product of the Masonic literacy, of your sense of commitment, if your understanding of obligations, that you are a man of your word, and that you wrestle with that. For nobody should take that for granted, should we? But I want to, that aside, whether your joy in, whether the value you gain from being a Freemason is the fraternal sense, which we all do, directly or indirectly, whether that's your emphasis, or you have a more wrinkled frown, and you wonder more deeply about the means to self-improvement, you ask yourself the question whether Freemasonry, the task or goal of Freemasonry, is to help you learn what it is to be a man. And presume, I guess, that we start off being a good man. A presumption that we could extend to a lot of people. I would say that most everybody is born a good person. And experience can be quite harsh. It can teach a very unpleasant version of the world. To regain the confidence and trust to connect with other people is a leap of faith. It needs to be reinforced. The world is not exactly the way we want it to be, but we have, like anything else going on, whether you're able to begin wars or ignore droughts, whether you're wrestling with the larger questions about how to deal with remote areas of the world where people are suffering, the tasks remain somewhat the same. We're built differently, and let's celebrate. I'll give you an idea about some of the more famous Masons of the world, just so we have a context for you and I. We are part of this. It doesn't mean that I think that we gain any celebrity because these people are part of Freemasonry, but it tells us a little more, I would think, about the men. Did you know Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, he was overthrown and killed in 1973. He'd been a Mason since 1935. The Nobel Prize winner for the English physicist, Sir Edward Appleton, worked on the discovery of the ionosphere. He earned the Nobel Prize in 1947. Of course, the man who heralds Masonic Home Companion every single show, Louis Armstrong. Did you know Thomas Augustin Arne, the English composer best known for Rule Britannia, Britannia, Rule the Way, and for his setting of the British National Anthem? English antiquarian Elias Ashmole donated his remarkable collection to Oxford University in 1677 to found the Ashmolean Museum. He was made a Mason in 1646. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, president and father of modern Turkey. Gebert Leibrecht Bulcher, Prussian field marshal who drove Napoleon out of Prussia, crossed the Rhine and entered Paris, came to the aid of a fellow Mason, the Duke of Wellington at Waterloo. Simon Bolivar led the 20-year struggle to liberate South America from Spanish rule. He became a Mason in Cadiz, Spain, and in 1807 entered the Scottish Rite and Knights Templars in Paris. In 1824, he founded the Lodge Order and Liberty No. 2 in Peru. James Boswell, Scottish writer, whose biography of Dr. Johnson was one of the great classics of English literature. Samuel Johnson is just a most remarkable, remarkable writer. I would recommend his material. Google him and get a copy of that biography and some of the writings of Johnson. Some of the letters are striking. Joseph Brant, chief of the Mohawks, the first Native American to enter the craft. He was initiated in 1776. Oh, reminds me, please plan to attend March 23rd, the Sankey Lecture, Dr. Joy Porter. I'll maybe talk a little bit about her book, do a little bit of more of a review of her book, Native American Freemasons. Henry Peter Brougham, Scottish statesman and reformer. He worked for the abolition of slavery, and his famous speech ensured the passage of the Reform Bill of 1831. Aha, coming up, of course, Robbie Burns, poet and enthusiastic Mason. So get ready for that. What's that coming up on 26th of January, Robbie Burns Day? I'll dust off my grandfather's book, Cyril's book of well-thumbed book of the Bard's poems that day. And maybe I'll do it later today. Sir Malcolm Campbell, the land speed record holder. Aha! Gentlemen, did you know Casanova, the Italian adventurer? Let's call him an adventurer. Marc Chagall. Ah, the Russian artist who spent most of his working life in Paris. He was a Freemason. Of course, Winston Churchill. Buffalo Bill Cody, American frontiersman and showman. Nat King Cole, American singer. David Crockett. Davy Crockett, the American frontiersman. Jim Davidson, American British entertainer, presented Big Break and Generation Game, founder of the British Forces Foundation, set up to provide entertainment to British forces worldwide. So we remember the women and men who are off defending our principles and values. Cecil B. DeMille, the American film pioneer. Many of the early studio bosses and their stars were Masons. Jack Dempsey, the American heavyweight boxing champion, world champion for 7 years from 1919. And of course, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the novelist and creator of Sherlock Holmes. Jean-Henri Dunant, Swiss humanist and founder of the Red Cross. Big shoes to follow. Duke Ellington. Incredible. Duke Ellington was W.C. Fields. My little chickadee. Sir Alexander Fleming, the Scottish bacteriologist and discoverer of penicillin. Henry Ford. Benjamin Franklin. Giuseppe Garibaldi, the Italian patriot and hero. Richard Gatling. He invented, of course, the Gatling gun. William S. Gilbert, English poet and playwright, worked with fellow Mason Sir Arthur Sullivan. Gilbert and Sullivan? Ah. I know there's some people up in the Ottawa Valley that are just revel in their work. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, the German poet and greatest figure in all German literature. Joseph Guillotin, the French physicist who invented the guillotine as a humane form of execution. Bless you. Earl Haig, the Scottish soldier. Prince Hall, the first American black Freemason, initiated in an Irish military lodge in 1775. Oliver Hardy, the American comedian, best known as half of Laurel and Hardy. And one of my favorites, Franz Joseph Haydn, Grandpa Haydn, I guess you'd say. The influence on Mozart and Beethoven, who's to say? His music is captivating, transcendent. Josiah Henson, American Methodist minister. He escaped from slavery in Kentucky and journeyed, came up to Canada and inspired the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Josiah Henson. Charles Hilton, the American hotelier, founder of the Hilton chain. William Hogarth, the English painter and significant English painter and engraver. He did some interesting work, even capturing Freemasons on their way back from a meeting in a sort of a cartoonish form. J. Edgar Hoover, American law enforcement officer, head of the FBI for almost 50 years. Harry Houdini, escapologist. Edward Jenner, English physician whose discovery of the principle of vaccination led ultimately to the complete eradication of smallpox. The kings of England and Scotland, Edward the VII, Edward the VIII, and George the VI. Rudyard Kipling, English writer, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Lord Kitchener, an English soldier, Secretary of State of War during World War I. His face became famous to generations through the poster, Your Country Needs You. Charles Lindbergh, the American aviator, he made a first nonstop flight across the Atlantic in 1927. And of course, Franz von Liszt, the Hungarian composer and virtuoso pianist. I think we did a show on him last week, wasn't it? John McAdam, the Scottish engineer, developed the macadamizing process for making roads waterproof. Think of Freemasonry every time you drive along a stretch of road. If it wasn't for a Freemason, Jacques-Étienne Montgolfier, the French inventor, and his brother developed the first hot air balloon. Of course, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Alexander Pope. Now, here's a list of presidents of the United States. George Washington, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, James Polk, James Buchanan, Andrew Johnson, James Garfield, William McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, William H. Taft, Warren G. Harding, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry S. Truman, Lyndon B. Johnson, Gerald Ford, Alexander Pushkin, the Russian poet, Eugene Onegin and Boris Godunov, incredible works. And there have been the operas, all of them operas. Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles, the English colonist, the founder of Singapore. And when he came back, he founded the Zoological Society. Paul Revere, Eddie Rickenbacker, the aviator, and decorated eighth in both World Wars. The Ringling Brothers, all seven brothers and their father were Masons. Sugar Ray Robinson, the American boxer. Boys my age will all remember Roy Rogers. Nathan Rothschild, the Anglo-German financier, established the London branch of the famous bank founded by his father. His brother, also a Mason, established the Paris branch. Jean-Joseph Roger de Lille, a French composer, most famous for his work now known as Le Marseillais. And if you love Casablanca, you all know the impact of that tune. Interesting to note that Arne, who composed Rule Britannia, and John Philip Sousa, the famous American composer of patriotic music, were all Masons. Antoine Joseph Sax, Belgian instrument maker, inventor of the sax horn and saxophone. Robert Falcon Scott, the English polar explorer. He perished in Antarctica. Sir Walter Scott, Scottish novelist and poet. Peter Sellers, he was one of the graft. Ernest Shackleton, Jan Sibelius, Finnish composer. Prolific composer of Masonic music. We'll do a show on Sibelius coming up, okay? I'll make a little note of that. And who else have we got? John Philip Sousa. Charles Stratton, the American midget who toured with B.T. Barnum as General Tom Thumb. He's a Freemason. And, of course, Arthur Sullivan. He also composed Onward Christian Soldiers. Jonathan Swift, I've talked about, produced the Gulliver Travels parable. Irish poet and satirist and the Dean of St. Patrick's. Alfred von Tirpitz, the German naval officer and creator of the modern German Navy prior to World War I. Voltaire, the French writer and philosopher, on the 7th of April, 1778, 2 months before his death, he was escorted by Benjamin Franklin to lodge Le Neuf Soir in Paris and was initiated into the craft. Booker T. Washington, the American educator and author, highly influential both through his works on the American black and as a promoter of racial harmony. John Wayne, the Duke of Wellington, the Anglo-Irish soldier and statesman. And Oscar Wilde, Anglo-Irish wit and dramatist. And added to that list, you. Absolutely. Absolutely. These are people whose great works reminds us of the longevity of Freemasonry and of the caliber. I'm sure there are other organizations that have appealed to a great many very stalwart and straightforward men, people who make contributions in their communities. But when you gather it together, I think that the potential for Freemasonry is always handed to the next generation, but it would become, it would go sideways if the work of previous generations is lost. I hope that never happens and becomes lost, like the lost word, I guess. When we stop talking, when we stop talking about our history, is when we begin to, when it begins to have less relevance to us. We have to have opinion in order for the, it seems to be what's being told us. It's our opinions about the history. It doesn't have to necessarily be the same, but we have an opinion that's qualified. And we need to do that by studying, opening up that daily advancement in our Masonic knowledge. And we do that in many, many different ways. First and foremost, as it always has been, is the matter of conscience, the matter of our ability to reason. And not everybody has the same abilities. Some are born with higher levels and others with what they are. So the importance, of course, is linking, that's in my mind, is linking our future with our past. Not to say that without knowing our past, we cannot know which direction we're going from. Or we, if we ignore our history, we will commit the same mistakes over and over. It's looking at our history objectively, not only to seek out the things that soothe us and are familiar and wanted, but the unintended outcomes. The only way that we learn from history is when we realize that the distance in time allows us to look at events in a dispassionate way and learn from both sides of the coin. The intended and unintended, the pleasant and unpleasant events. That way, we qualify, we better qualify our opinion and refine the decisions that come to us today and tomorrow. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about somebody that I hinted at a bit earlier. I want to help share a little bit of information about, so we have, so this can be a bit of an advancement in your Masonic knowledge today. So I'll talk a little bit about Reverend James Anderson. James was, or you know, as we know him, Jim, was known as, he was born in 1679 and he passed on in 1739. So I'll talk a little bit about him, a little bit about John de Saulnier, his confederate, and a little bit about some of the actions in between, the things about the meeting at the lodge that started or is claimed to have started Freemasonry at the, you know, the pub, four lodges get together, 1717-ish. James Anderson was the son of an Aberdeen glazier, an admitted Mason to the Lodge of Aberdeen. A surviving seal shows Anderson's respect for his father's Masonic membership. Its crest depicts Anderson Sr.'s Masonic mark at its head. Anderson studied divinity at Marischal College, or at least he tried to. In the religious conflicts that marked the period of his education, the college Episcopalian lecturer in divinity had been replaced by a Presbyterian. The Presbyterians were running the Church of Scotland at the time. However, the Presbyterians had not yet found a suitable candidate to fill this among many other enforced vacant posts. It was perhaps this kind of experience that gave Anderson an insight into the folly of dividing men according to religious affiliation. In any case, he so divided himself. He sought a Presbyterian ministry. Apparently unable to find a position in Scotland suitable for a young would-be minister, Anderson came south to London. after the union of England and Scotland in 1707. In London, he married an English widow, providing him with sufficient funds to begin a small Presbyterian ministry. In 1710, he took over a former Huguenot chapel in Swallow Street, Westminster, and established himself as an occasionally controversial Presbyterian minister, significantly beyond the control of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. The Swallow Street chapel had, interestingly, served the father of Huguenot immigré Jean Theophilus de Saulier. De Saulier would become the Grand Lodge's third Grand Master in 1719. Perhaps de Saulier first met Anderson at the chapel while on a sentimental visit. According to Professor David Stevenson's fascinating paper, Anderson, Man, and Mason, the first of Anderson's printed sermons, delivered on the 6th of January, 1712, well illustrates Reverend James Anderson's attitudes. Anderson wrote of how the country was blessed by having a good Protestant sovereign and a happy constitution, having been delivered from the jaws of popery and slavery by the Revolution of 1688. But dangers threatened. The growth of popery were alarming, for by their principles, Catholics recognized a foreigner, the Jacobite pretender, as rightful king. odd reading about it, doesn't it seem to you? Danger also lurked within the contagion of skepticism and deism. There were too many that either think God is an idle spectator of the affairs of the world and will allow him no further superintendency over it than a clockmaker or an architect, so says Anderson. That's the idea of deism. God's there, but not an active link, not an active influence. This makes Anderson's Whig and Hanoverian sympathies clear. It also shows his notable antipathy to deism, a point of view sometimes associated with Anderson's famous charge concerning God and religion, which he included in the constitutions, and which, more than anything else, perhaps, made the constitution something of a manifesto to the European Enlightenment. Yes, that would be our Constitution and the Charges, Section 6 in our Book of Constitution. And I recommend those for you to a reading of those if you haven't taken a look at them recently, especially the one on the charge concerning God and religion. Anderson's own ministry was marked by a considerably less harmonious spirit than he celebrated as emanating from a good Protestant sovereign and happy constitution. Anderson, poor Scots Presbyterian in London, saw it in his duty to comment on things that others felt were none of his business. Anderson drew fire for his practice of writing fair and balanced obituaries, as he saw them, of religious leaders of denominations other than his own. Nothing like making mom unhappy. To those who dislike such presumption, Anderson appeared to as a jumped-up, self-appointed religious commentator from a suspect source. He was just ahead of his time, wasn't he? Every talk show host would love to sit down with this man today. A man judged by Anglicans as priggish, superior upstart, appeared to persons of his own denomination as a shameful latitudinarian, or even far worse, a sniveling mass John, a provider of Catholic masses. It was said that after his death, that Presbyterians were wont to call the Scot Bishop Anderson. This jibe may have more than one meaning. One cannot help thinking of Private Eye's satirical creation, the highly opinionated vicar of St. Albans, ex-Prime Minister Tony Blair, who knows a Catholic bishop's duty far better than a Catholic bishop. Anderson was remarkably confident in his views. And when we come to look at his novel ideas concerning Masonry and religion, we may be astounded at his apparent guileless self-assurance. Anderson saw it his business to tell any religious person their business. Boy, don't you just love this guy more and more? Don't be shy there, Jimmy. Just say what's on your mind there. You can imagine he'd need to be told that. So we got a measure of the guy, a little bit outspoken, eh? But Not being subject to religious control, as he would have been in Scotland, the obscure Anderson felt at liberty to say what he thought, once he considered it principled and necessary. Once he felt something was right, it was right. Admittedly, he was not, in his own mind, a seeker after dissension or conflict in religious matters. There you go. He was speaking what he felt was valid opinions. But I wonder if we're saying that he doesn't take any responsibility for any conflict that might occur about, or any resentment that might occur about his comments. He saw fit to educate those who read his usually pacific sermons that the martyrdom of King Charles I could not, as was often maintained, be laid at the door of Scottish Presbyterians and Presbyterians in general. This, from a man who would later forbid discussions of religion or politics in lodges, was a highly political statement, sure to inflame the opponents of one surely considered as another petty dissenter. Anderson had a lot to prove. In 1715, at the height of national agitation over the Jacobite rebellion against King George I, which was launched from Scotland, a sermon of Anderson's declared the innocence of Presbyterians against the calumny of regicide. In the year of the rebellion, this assertion bore the implication that the Jacobites, being ready to war against the lawful king, were on a moral par with those who had been seen fit to execute Charles Stuart in 1649. So that's the man. We'll come back. The momentous events at the Apple Tree Tavern in 1716 are worth a bit of your attention, I hope. This rubric should perhaps have served as the newspaper headline announcing an event that allegedly occurred sometime, probably late in the year of 1716. That neither it nor anything like it did make the late edition should give us pause. That is to say, there is no corroborative evidence whatsoever that for the report of the origins of the Grand Lodge. Say it like it is. Furthermore, that report only made its appearance 22 years after the event described. And in the space of those 22 years, a period punctuated with reports as to the Freemasons' affairs, both public and private, there is absolutely nothing to suggest that any such event ever happened. The general belief was that the Grand Lodge, or something very much like it, had always existed. Freemasonry is customarily described in newspaper reports as that honorable and ancient fraternity. This itself shows just how effective the Grand Lodge spin had been. The pretense must stand as one of the greatest examples of sleight of hand in history. And who wrote that account when it did finally appear? The one and only telling of the founding of the Grand Lodge came from the pen of Reverend James Anderson, while filling out his earlier 1723 history of Freemasonry. It does not purport to be the work of an eyewitness. There is no indication that the writer of the account was present, nor is there any doubt in the writer's account that the reader is receiving truth in the form of established fact. Here is the record, as first printed in the new book of constitutions of the ancient and honorable fraternity of free and accepted Masons, published by Caesar Ward and Richard Chandler in England in 1738, on page 114. AD 1716, it says, the few lodges at London thought fit to cement under a Grand Master as the center of union and harmony vis-a-vis the lodges that met. There follows a list of four lodges, it says. The Goose and Gridiron, St. Paul's Churchyard. According to the official engraved list of lodges for 1729, the lodge was established in 1691. A lodge at the Crown Ale House, Lincoln's Inn Fields. According to the above list, this lodge was established in 1712. A lodge at the Rummer and Grapes, Channel Row, Westminster, subsequently known as the Horn Lodge. The lodge at the Apple Tree Tavern, Charles Street, Covent Garden, now the Lodge of Fortitude and Old Cumberland, number 12. Its date of origin is unknown. Anderson's account continues. They and some old brethren met at the said apple tree, and having put into the chair the oldest master mason, now the master of a lodge, they constituted themselves a grand lodge pro tempore in due form, and forthwith revived the quarterly communication of the officers of lodges called the grand lodge, resolved to hold the annual assembly and feast, and then to choose a grand master from among themselves, till they should have the honor of a noble brother at their head. Accordingly, on St. John Baptist's day, in the third year of King George the First, A.D. 1717, the assembly and feast of the free and accepted masons was held at the Forsett Goose and Gridiron Alehouse. Before dinner, the oldest master mason, now the master of a lodge, in the chair, proposed a list of proper candidates. And the brethren, by a majority of hands, elected Mr. Anthony Sayre, gentleman, Grand Master of Masons. And that was moved by Captain Joseph Elliot Grand, and seconded by Mr. Jacob Lamball, Carpenter Wardens, who, being forthwith invested with the badge of office and power by the said oldest mason and installed, was duly congratulated by the assembly, who paid him the homage. Sayre, Grand Master, commended the masons and wardens of lodges to meet the grand officers every quarter in communication at the place that he should appoint in his summons sent by the tiler. Now, astute readers will have observed that the constitution of this Grand Lodge took place in 1716, according to Anderson, and that a master mason was put in the chair. This man, whoever he was, appears to have been the first master of this Grand Lodge, if not given a title of Grand Master. All official Masonic histories date the founding of the first Grand Lodge at 1717, the date of the assembly and feast. It should be stressed that the assembly of officers called Grand Lodge, a getting together of four lodges initially for a single purpose, namely to revive the quarterly assemblies or communication of officers, is not a regulatory or governing body. Its purpose seems solely to have been to reestablish four annual meetings in the tradition of the old guilds, which tended to assemble at the solstices and equinoxes. St. John Baptist's day brought together the Mason's patron saint, St. John the Baptist, and the midsummer celebration. They appeared to have been doing no more than planning a feast, a summer's day shindig. John Hamill, in the Craft Crucible in 1986, and Bernard E. Jones, the Freemason's Guide and Compendium, second edition, 1956, both assert that the claim of Anderson that the meeting of 1716 intended to revive the quarterly communication and extant Masonic tradition is untenable. There being no evidence of either a Grand Lodge or any similar governing body having existed before 1717. This statement, says our friend Churchton, is flawed. First, it does not address its pre-stated denial regarding the revival of the quarterly communication. It says that there has been no Grand Lodge or similar governing body before 1717. But we have no evidence to suggest the Grand Lodge, as constituted according to Anderson, was a governing body in any sense. That there emerged a governing body in the years following the meeting only begs further the questions. Second, there is evidence of assemblies of Freemasons being summoned. The Roberts Constitution, so Roberts' print of 1722, early Masonic pamphlets by Knopp, Hamer, and Jones, refers to an assembly of Masons called to London in the year 1663. Anderson's Constitution of 1738 also refers to a grand assembly of Masons called in 1663 by Grand Master Henry German, J-E-R-M-Y-N, Henry German, to establish rules to reorganize masonry after disruptions ensuing from the Civil War. Incidentally, when Wren Christopher Wren went to Paris in 1665 to meet the craftsmen of that city, it was German, then ambassador to Paris, who gained Wren the relevant introductions. Henry German, Grand Master of the Freemasons? By Anthony Adolph, Freemasonry Today, number 6, page 46. Interesting reference. Go and check it out for yourself. John Hamill states that the reason why a Grand Lodge came into existence in 1717 has never been answered satisfactorily. He wrote that, you can reference his work, Hamill's work in The Craft, page 42. This is reasonable, if not something of an understatement, but when one looks afresh at the perspective of craft undergoing particular difficulties, reasonable suggestions may be advanced to account for this phenomenon. Again, it is vital to realize that accepted Freemasonry was operating within the world of freestone masons, albeit as an elite group or coterie. In 1670, Parliament passed an act for the rebuilding of London after the Great Fire. The fire was in 1666, with specific taxes to be raised for the reconstruction of churches. Coal sent to London from the north, for example, was to be taxed for this purpose. The taxation measure required renewal. In the 29th of September 1700, Parliament passed the third and last measure. 16 years later, in September 1716, the measure expired. The money was drying up. St. Paul's Cathedral was complete and the churches of London were mostly rebuilt. The world of London masonry was in trouble. Masons were vulnerable. A reduction in the number of working masons in London was clearly an issue for these, let us note, very small groups of interested parties. In this context, a revival of quarterly assemblies does not appear altogether strange. The feasts may have brought in new paying gentlemen members who forked out for some kind of association with the Masons Fellowship, a place in a convivial society. This period saw a great growth in the number of clubs and occasional coffee house fraternities. Note that the old religious context had all but evaporated. It is true that an aristocratic patron might assist the status and patronage of the craft in general. We might reasonably speculate that the four lodges met at the apple tree to plan a feast and assembly for midsummer, run by a novel and perhaps temporary organizational umbrella called a Grand Lodge. A Grand Lodge might host a grand party. This conclusion is, of course, conjectural. It is also unclear as to what the specific status was of the lodges mentioned. We have no minutes from the lodges concerned at this time at all. Lodges in London probably did not keep minutes as a rule. Were they dominated by gentlemen or by stonemasons? Who was behind the gathering of four lodges, and did it ever really happen? We are not compelled to believe it did. It is worth noting that it had been the custom of English guilds to hold quarterly communications, usually held on Michaelmas Day, the 25th of September, the Feast of St. John the Evangelist, the 27th of December, Lady Day, the 25th of March. And according to Anderson, only annual assemblies were held on in 1717, 1718, and 1719. Anthony Sayre, the gentleman called by Anderson the Grand Master of this Grand Lodge, may have been a convenient choice simply because a family called Sayre ran a bookshop in St. Paul's Churchyard, where the Goose and Gridiron Lodge met. And you can refer, if you want to probe into that question a little bit more, go to Ars Quattro Coronati, number 88. It was printed in 1975. And look for T. Beck's Prestonian Lecture of 1975. Fascinating. So I'll leave that for you. We add a little more history, improve the accuracy, and it presents questions for us. Then, whenever we make assumptions, they are prone to, like anything, they are prone to change when we know more accurate facts. And so we have it. We're not any different than science in that respect, or the arts in that respect. So even our history, hopefully, will improve and become more accurate as time goes on. The brilliance of de Saulnier, he was born in 1683 and he passed away in 1744, lead chiefly in science, or as it was called in the day, natural philosophy. De Saulnier was also extremely adept at public relations. Born in La Rochelle, the infant Jean de Augolier was brought to England at the age of two from an increasingly intolerant Catholic France. The Edict of Nantes had once protected Protestants, but Louis IV revoked it in 1685. De Saulnier, like Anderson, had both reason and experience to favor a doctrine of universal religious toleration. He was educated as not Jean, but John de Saulnier at Christ Church in Oxford, and he lectured on experimental philosophy at Hart Hall in 1710. He graduated with his master's in 1712. 2 years later, he was made a fellow of the Royal Society, where he occupied the post of curator, conducting experiments often for the gaze of the interested public. He invented the planetarium and published works on physics, astronomy, and mechanics. He speculated on the idea that corporeal nature could be changed if atoms, which by that meant original particles, were split. You can see, find this in his work from 1734, A Course of Experimental Philosophy. De Saulnier was a great admirer of Newton. This admiration verging on worship is evinced in De Saulnier's extraordinarily devoted poem, The Newtonian System, which he published in 1728. Devotion to Newton seems to have some extent to have encompassed aspects of the vision of Newton's fervent, if heretical, spirituality and religious philosophy. Newton did not believe in the Holy Trinity as understood in the Church of England's 39 Articles of Belief, nor, contrary to what he has come to represent, did he believe in the deist concept of an absent divine mechanician. Newton was exercised by the vision of a living universe in which the divine power was present in every living, every level. His imaginative universe consisted of a great living alchemical system whose lineaments could be revealed abstractly by mathematical physics. Newton's questioning mind was fascinated by the alchemically informed theosophic works of Jacob Boehm. Boehm described a universe that was an expression of divine spiritual dynamics in which the human being should look to his absolute center, his heart. Images of the center, often identified with the heart, emerge in Masonic rituals after the time of de Saulnier. It may be conjectured that de Saulnier had at least a hand in the composition of the formerly, before 1725, unknown third-degree ritual. Formerly unknown before 1725. It's an add-on, a revision, an update, an upgrade. Hopefully they still go on to this day. Mathematics for Newton was part of the divine code, a concept analogous to Masonry's apotheosis of geometry. Newton shared the alchemical view that the ancient keys to divine knowledge had become obscured with time as man lost intimacy with the inner life of nature. Newton regarded the conflicting faiths of the world and Christian sectarianism as signs of the falling away from and the search for an ancient pristine knowledge. He believed that the structure of Solomon's temple contained fundamental insights into God's system of creation and gave keys to future knowledge. Newton's science, as noted by Michael White's Newton, the Last Sorcerer, which was printed in 1997, makes clear was a spiritual quest for God's primal revelation. After Newton, the world of science would come to embrace the mathematical structure but ignore the vision that inspired it. This was not the case as regards Freemasonry. It does not take much imagination to see how such an almost evangelical conviction of the need for a kind of revolutionary divine science could tie in with the traditions of the ancient craft. Such an idea may even in the bright mind of de Saulier give free and accepted Masonry a purpose it either had not had before, or which could be said to have lain untapped within it. Furthermore, de Saulier, a near victim of religious persecution, understood as well as anybody the value of the Masonic meeting point, effectively an abstraction of high Christian principle. Freemasonry is going to be different after de Saulier. As chaplain to the Prince of Wales, de Saulier also had vested interest in the harmonious continuance of the Protestant Hanoverian dynasty, considered by many a Whig as a defense of liberty, especially the liberty of Whigs. The word harmony meant a great deal to de Saulier, and it is prominent in Anderson's Constitutions. De Saulier wrote the dedication, and some scholars believe even more. Strangely, de Saulier's correspondence, which must have been massive, has almost completely disappeared. It is possible that de Saulier came to the craft via the Midsummer Feast Anderson reports to have taken place at the Goose and Gridiron Pub in 1717. With the expiry of a government measure to promote reconstruction of London in September of 1716, the lodges may have been aware of financial constraints. If the alleged feast was an opportunity to attract new members, could de Saulier have been one of them? With all his social and political connections, de Saulier was useful to the craft, or was it the other way around? The most widely known Freemason of the time, Sir Christopher Wren, was an old Tory, and the government did not care for old Tories. But de Saulier was Protestant, loyal, and even grateful. His back was turned against the Stuart past of civil disorder and religious conflict. A man for whom the Reformation meant salvation from the Dark Ages. In 1719, de Saulier was elected Grand Master of the Free and Accepted Masons of London, seeing perhaps a peculiar potential within the craft. The potential had little to do with architecture. In his poem, The Newtonian System of the World, The Best Model of Government, an allegorical poem published in 1728, de Saulier is inspired by aspects of Newton's philosophy. Accepted Freemasonry's interest in geometry perhaps began to look more exciting, even prescient. Of course, it might need a touch of modernizing, a new and improved method to rid the pristine essence of its discredited Gothic impurities. Anderson could see to that. Anderson thought Gothic architecture was rubbish, a curious position for a promoter of Masonry. This seems to have been how de Saulier saw it. Freemasonry had, throughout all the vicissitudes of history, preserved knowledge that could now, under a reasonable government, revolutionize the world. At the fountains of religion was a divine science. That is to say, science and religion were originally one, both knowledge and consciousness of knowledge. The knowledge was God's, its language, geometry. The music of the spheres sang for everyone who had ears to hear, whether Anglican, Catholic, nonconformist, or heretic. The original religion was divine science. Return to it and religious division might properly vanish. The music of his Pythagoras spheres did represent that ancient harmony of government, when kings were not ambitions yet to gain, other dominions but their own maintain. When to protect, they only bore the sway, and love, not fear, taught subjects to obey. These were de Saulier's words. Geometry had no sex, no rival churches, no popes, no heretics. Geometry, the big G, was demonstrable to human reason everywhere. As Anderson would write in 1738 edition of his Constitutions, reason surveys the lodge and makes us one. God, as reason itself, is the classic Enlightenment credo or assumption. To be guided into divine science, one needed a harmonious mind enlightened by reason divine. Newton, as we have seen, believed that the structure of Solomon's temple contained lost insights into God's system of creation, the keys to future knowledge. But as accepted Masons were told, the original secrets had not been lost through an ancient tragedy. Newton and de Saulnier shared the view that the ancient keys to divine knowledge had become obscured with time, as man lost intimacy with the inner life of nature. Newton regarded the conflicting faiths of the world and Christian sectarianism as signs of the falling away from antediluvian pristine knowledge. This concept had been an esoteric and hermetic theme of continental renaissance since the late 15th century. Knowledge was rediscovery. Antiquarians had a hand in science. Was it then de Saulnier who introduced the most famous antiquarian of the age to free and accepted masonry? William Stukeley. Reverend Dr. William Stukeley, he was born in 1687 and passed away in 1765. He was 5 years old when his great antiquarian predecessor, Elias Ashmole, died. Famous today for his pioneering work on Stonehenge, Druidism, and the Stones of Avebury, Stukeley was secretary and fellow, 1717, of the Society of Antiquarians, as well as being a fellow of the Royal College, as well as de Saulnier. So we'll come back to that. Do you mind? Some challenges in the workings. But interesting to understand the thinking of the time. The context tells us much more about the result, helps us to understand the result, and perhaps helps us to connect with this notion of geometry being the one religion in which the divine faith in which all men can agree. No sects, no conflicts. The universal language of science. So the G that's prominent in our Masonic world, geometry. And now we see that the argument put forward that geometry is the voice of the divine, the creator. How do you separate the two? You don't. We can't. So we see, I think, the importance of to us of the thinking that formed Freemasonry at its beginnings. It almost seems to me trivial in a way that there were four lodges, or whether there was an intent to form a great organization. That seems to me a matter of sort of bureaucracy or governance. And I know it's important, but I think focus on that might obscure some of the more important things that were going on. The thinking of the day to create an opportunity for all people to work together, to find harmony and inclusion. Of course, against a background of civil war and wholesale turmoil, great distress, the city had burned. We'd had kings beheaded, king beheaded, a civil war. We had gone through Cromwell. The influences were clear. We need some form of leadership was important. But we also hear the message that it wasn't power, it wasn't threat, it wasn't criticism that brought about the harmony. It was love, respect. Even today, when we hear of a British monarch, she's spoken of with great respect. And it's, we may separate out the politic and the representation, symbolic representation, because we can always find an aspect that speaks to all of us. This helps to define us. We may not like our history, but how much of that really matters in the big scheme of things? It is what it is. Great ideas. They were built on great ideas. 21st century. Let's come back and I'll wrap up this part of the program. I want to remind you of something that Dale Carnegie hints in his influential material. I suggest to you that if you're looking for Freemasonry, if you want to know the secrets of Freemasonry, the secret perhaps is that it's you. You are Freemasonry. You. In order to have some bearing or influence in the world, we need to be able to sound differently than common people. The temperament of a Freemason, we can argue, would be different, more moderate, more contemplative. It's almost like our tempers, our temperament is a barrier to our connection with nature, with the great divine. So can we continue to reason through and just talk about our problems as gentlemen? We don't necessarily have to agree with another person's point of view, but we can always and should encourage it and encourage a thoughtful audience, so that we can look at both sides. So instead of making decisions based on the forcefulness of one particular personality over another, we make decisions based on the merit of ideas. That it can be quite a daunting task, as we all know. So that's why I guess our growth is daily. It's constant. So let me just briefly hint here at some of the work of Manly P. Hall again. We're talking here about the entered apprentice, and Hall is talking about growth being the result of exercise and the intensifying of vibratory rates. Yes, a little bit chewy for this time of the day, I would think, but what part of Freemasonry isn't? Hall was esoteric. Hall was a philosophy. He represents that to a great many people. His work takes a while to understand. It's not something that could be absorbed at first reading. This is more contemplative work. He talked about the obviousness of the rough ashlar symbolizing the body. He also talked about it representing the cosmic root substance, which is taken out of the quarry of the universe by the first expressions of intelligence. The rough ashlar, the body, is taken out of the quarry of the universe by the first expressions of intelligence, and molded by them into ever finer and more perfect lines until finally it becomes the perfect stone for the builder's temple. All students, he says, of human nature realize that every expression of man depends upon organic quality, that in every living thing this differs, and that the fineness of this matter is the certain indication of growth, mental, physical, or spiritual. True to the doctrines of his craft, the entered apprentice must beautify his temple. He must build within himself by his actions, by the power of his hand and the tools of his craft, certain qualities which make possible his initiation into the higher degrees of the spiritual lodge. We know that the cube block is symbolic of the tomb. It is also well known that the entered apprentice is incapable of rolling away the stone or of transmuting it into a greater or higher thing. But it is his privilege to purify and glorify that stone and begin the great work of preparing it for the temple of his king. Few realize that since the universe is made up of individuals in various stages of development, responsibility is consequentially individual. And everything which man wishes to gain, he must himself build and maintain. If he is to use his finer bodies for the purpose for which they were intended, he must treat them well, that they may be a good and faithful servants in the great work he is preparing for. The work being the preparation of the temple, the temple being within the mind of a man. What purpose do you put to the development, to the balance that's necessary to be able to examine things objectively, to be able to listen and appreciate the scholarly work that may not agree and hopefully throws new light onto our preconceptions, means that we're in a constant state of change. And that if we ever get that sense of comfort underneath us, that we must immediately be alarmed that there's something going on that's desperately wrong. That the world around us provides sustenance for our appetite for learning, and that you and I have the opportunity that very few Masons have ever had before. I hope as you plunge forward into 2013 that you will have a confident grasp of where you are within your fraternal and Masonic development, that you are where you are. You alone know whether you have answered the necessary questions satisfactorily. You alone know that there may be other answers. So respect one another, respect yourself above all. Remember that the great architect of the universe who watches over us all, the divine power, is there with you and with all of us. Commit random acts of Masonic kindness wherever you be, and look forward to joining us all in Lodge real soon.
in life I've made, they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey,
always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death is the final word. You must always face the curtain.
Man, that's good.